Support for 51% comes from Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, a community-owned natural grocery store dedicated to sustainable agriculture, the local economy, and the environment, working within the community to better Berkshire County one basket at a time. Berkshire.coop.
On this week's 51%, we hear from a consultant who helps to advance women in the corporate world.
My goal is actually to get people talking about gender in the workplace in a constructive way. And the reason I say that is men are scared to death to have this conversation.
And we hear a story about modern day slavery. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. My future is... Jeffrey Tobias Halter is a corporate gender strategist and leading expert on engaging men to advance women. He is president of Why Women, a strategic consulting company based in Georgia. He says that especially after the Women's March on Washington and other marches and rallies, conversations around workplace equality are not going away, and it's time for men to join the fight to change workplace culture and policies. I asked him, what is a corporate gender strategist?
So it's kind of something I created, actually. In the last 15 years, what I have figured out is a lot of companies have diversity or women's strategies, but they tend to be very disjointed. They might be owned by HR. They might be owned by diversity. They're really not integrated into the sales arm. They're really not integrated into the operation or supply chain element. Senior leadership may not know its role. You may have supplier diversity. And so what I help companies do is to create really tightly integrated women's leadership strategies with scorecards, measures, and metrics, and then engage senior leaders, which are still 85% men. And I choose to focus on women because it's the common denominator. You know, everything I'm going to say in this interview, everything I talk about is equally applicable to other dimensions of diversity. But if we can't have a strategy and a genuine conversation around women, why are we going to talk about race? Why are we going to talk about other dimensions of the workplace? So I choose to focus on gender. And this is a strategy, this integrated strategy piece is something that, you know, only about 50 of the Fortune 500 are actually doing really, really well. So there's a huge opportunity for companies to get a lot better at this.
Do they want to get a lot better at this?
It's so funny you ask that. Yes, believe it or not, they do. What you're finding today is if you talk to most senior leadership teams, and my business is corporate, so I can't speak to social agendas or government or politics, any of that. What I will tell you is organizations are saying we need to advance women. But here's the problem. It's number 5 or 6 on their list of initiatives. And 1, 2, and 3 are really big. It's about keeping the doors open. It's about trying to eke out revenue in the 5 to 7% range. It's about trying to make operating profit in the 10 to 12% range, which is really hard based on single digit revenue growth. And then the last piece that I talk to companies about is your company reputation is actually under attack. You are one social media blast away, or if you look at the case of Uber, you're one bad employee away from everything being front page. And so these three things, grow revenue, improve operating profit, enhance company reputations, have to link to women. And that's how we're going to do a much better job. And companies are feeling the pain. There's a war for talent. And it's all embedded in what's going on in business today.
Right. You mentioned before that there are few women at the top of the corporate ladder, 85% men, right? So what is the problem here? What is the barrier? Is it that women aren't applying for the positions? Is it on the corporate side? You know, what in the corporate realm is the problem? And is it in a particular area of a company?
Yeah, great question. And here's what's really fascinating. Companies have been trying to advance women for 15 years. If there was one answer, we've had a lot of really smart people working on it, and we would have solved this. The problem is it's literally a dozen different issues that each play a small piece in holding women back. And I'll just go into a couple of the big ones, because you said, what are the barriers? What are companies doing? Many companies are actually very well intended, but what happens is the very culture of getting to the top can sometimes be intimidating. Oh, by the way, for men and women. If you think about that rare air, if you're in a company of 50,000 people and the top 1% are going to get to the top, well, that says there are 500 people who are qualified for that job. So then you get into what are the characteristics of that 1% of the 1% that are going to get there? Well, most women believe it's performance, that a meritocracy actually works. What you find is at the top of the organization, excellent performance is a given. And so the differentiators become very subjective. Things like image, not the way you dress, but what do people say about you when you're not in the room? Are you seen as a strategic thinker? Are you seen as really understanding a company culture? And so that's one of the barriers to the C-suite, this notion that women put their head down, work really hard, but yet aren't aware of what people are saying about them when they're not in the room. And then a big piece of it is exposure. If people don't know who you are, then you're not going to get ahead, which leads to the second barrier, and that is women still tend to cluster in staff functions, marketing, HR, legal. The movers and shakers, the people who really run the company, come out of operating positions, P&L positions. And so if we're ever going to break the barrier to more women in the C-suite, we have to work on sales. We have to work on supply chain. We have to work on operating to get and promote women, which again leads to another barrier, which is typically the people in those operating roles have to have a breadth of experience, which means multiple relocations. And still today in this country, regardless of the level you're at, women still tend to do more, believe it or not, housework, more laundry, more cooking, and more childcare. And it's well documented that even very senior women are doing more than their husbands in those areas. And so those are just three of the interrelated factors that are conspiring to hold women kind of just at that, you know, VP to SVP level without making it to the C-suite.
I wanted to talk about your latest book, Why Women, The Leadership Imperative to Advancing Women and Engaging Men. Is it really the first business book written by a man on how companies can advance women? And why you? Why did you undertake this?
Yeah, that's really funny. I tell the story, if you had told me 15 years ago this is what I'd be doing, I would have laughed at you. I'm a sales guy. I was a sales manager, P&L responsibility. And in 2000, I guess it's been almost 17 years when I make that comment, I was running sales training for the Coca-Cola company. I was doing that staff rotation assignment before you go back out into the field to be a VP. And Coca-Cola had a $200 million discrimination lawsuit, something no company should ever go through. But literally overnight, I went from running sales training to running diversity education. And I'm a straight white guy, and I wondered, what meeting did I not go to get in charge of this project? Because clearly I had no clue what I was doing. But over the next 5 to 7 years, I would hear stories of racism and sexism and homophobia, things taking place in my company that I thought I knew pretty well that just caused me to change. And what happened is I chose to become an advocate. I chose to work in this field, and that's what I've spent the last 17 years doing. So previously, 10 years with Coca-Cola. My last role there was as director of diversity strategy, which was really talking about this strategic leadership piece. And then for the last six, I've been an independent consultant. I'm president of Why Women. And that company focuses on really everything we've talked about. But at the end of the day, what I found out was there was a unique power to being a white male in a business context. And, you know, literally you and I could stand in front of the same leadership team made up of mostly men, say the exact same thing, and their biases would say, oh my God, she's a raging feminist and he's an amazing businessman. And we have said the same thing. And so there are just things I can say and do that you can't. I can call them on their crap and they're going to listen in a much better vein. I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying I know what's sitting across the desk from me when I'm dealing with executive leadership teams.
So what is your Father of a Daughter initiative? What do you hope will come from it?
This is really interesting. As I started doing this work, I attend half a dozen women's leadership conferences a year. And that was before I left Coca-Cola. Now I spend my life at women's leadership conferences. What I found, though, was there were always 10 to 12 men there. And you're always kind of curious what the other guys are doing there. So you start talking to them and you find out there are actually a lot of men who want to advance women. My estimate is upwards of 30%. But we don't know what to do. We don't know what it looks like if we're advocating for women on a daily basis. And it's because, and this sounds just so eye-opening to women, because it's just, what do you mean you don't think about this? But we don't. Men of my era, and I'm a young boomer, wanted to raise strong daughters. We made sure we supported them, whether that was sports or music. We made sure our daughters went to great colleges. And when our daughter graduates and makes 78 cents to my son, when my daughter is faced with the same biases and overt sexism that exists in organizations today, I choose to do nothing, because I have never made the connection that if I'm not advocating for women today in the workplace, I'm in fact failing my daughter in the future. And it's because we never make the connection. And so the Father of Daughter Initiative is really a very simple opt-in program. Men print it out, commit to do one of 10 things, everything from seeking to understand to mentoring to encouraging women to apply. They put their daughter's name on it and sign it and post it in their workplace. And it marks them as an advocate for advancing women, but also for monitoring and checking biases and sexism that we know take place. And so I have been so pleasantly surprised. This has been picked up by a dozen Fortune 500 companies, and it works.
So which company, who is doing a good job when it comes to advancing women, when it comes to equality in the workplace? Who in the Fortune 500 universe is up there?
Right now, GE has just launched a huge initiative to move 20,000 women into operating roles because they need talent. They are really struggling to attract and keep millennials. And what easier thing to do than to take women from their existing pool and say, we're going to invest in you and we want to broaden your skill set. So this is a major initiative, 20,000 women that GE is doing. IBM's a great example. IBM announced they're moving 5,000 women into customer-facing roles. Again, they're trying to get more women in operating roles. Rockwell Automation, now this is a company most of your listeners probably haven't heard of. They're in a very boring industry called warehouse automation. So think ultra male domination. They actually trained over 1,000 men in becoming gender ally partners. And so teaching men how to be better advocates for advancing women. Deloitte is doing a great job with a program that they just launched called Family Leave. Individuals can take up to 16 weeks off for literally anything they want to do once or twice in their career. It may be to care for an aged parent. It may be a sibling with cancer. You may want to go backpack Europe, but it's literally your choice. And what's so powerful is I saw the chief people officer of Deloitte talk about this program, and somebody's got to write a check for that. Somebody has to pay for that 16 weeks. And they said, We don't know if the ROI is there, but it's the right thing to do. Well, lo and behold, 4 weeks after they got implemented, four women from four different operating units who didn't even know each other sent the head of HR a letter that said, I have to let you know, I was thinking about leaving the company because I have a sister with cancer. I have to take care of my aged mother and she's not in my city. And two others, well, all of a sudden you put the ROI on four literally partner level women. That's a couple million dollars right there by implementing this program. And Deloitte today would say it is cash neutral right now instead of costing them money because they've reduced turnover so greatly.
On the federal level, we have the Family and Medical Leave Act, and that allows for 12 weeks of leave in a year period for eligible employees and for specified reasons, and it's unpaid, though you have job security. So the difference is Deloitte saying 16 weeks, no questions asked, and it's paid.
Here's the other thing, you know, that's just so bizarre in our country, and so I'm going to get off my business soapbox for 30 seconds, but even the notion of if you're a woman having a child, you actually have to go on short-term disability to keep your salary going in many companies. And just the fact that we associate pregnancy in this country with being a disability speaks to, you know, just so many issues around how we just need to reframe this conversation in this country.
I'm curious, how do women react to what you do? Are they offended by it?
You know, it's funny you say that. I get a lot of women who are like, why are you here and what are you doing? And after they spend 10 to 15 minutes talking with me and my approach, they change their mind. They realize that there is a genuine intent to what I'm doing. And, you know, with all due respect, and what I tell them is, men still make up 85% of senior leadership in most companies. And so we're 85% of the problem, but we're 85% of the solution. Women can lean in all they want to, but you are never going to drive systemic change in organization without active engagement of men.
Is there something else, Jeff, worth a mention here?
I have an initiative that comes out about every 3 weeks. My goal is actually to get people talking about gender in the workplace in a constructive way. And the reason I say that is men are scared to death to have this conversation. We're so afraid we'll say or do something wrong that we choose not to talk about it. Men think women want to have this conversation. Well, the thing is, women don't want to lead this conversation. Women want to be respected as lawyers or engineers or doctors. They don't want to carry the flag for all things women. So I started a newsletter called Gender Conversation Quick Starters, and you can download that or get on my mailing list at my website, www.theletteryWomen.biz. And it comes out every 3 weeks, and it's three thought starters, something from the news, something from current events, something from a white paper to hold at a staff meeting, just to get you talking about gender in the workplace. And so these little subtle conversations, if we can start having these with 8 to 10 people in organizations, if we can do the father of daughter initiative, we can start to actually engage in this conversation, which is then going to drive change, which is then going to start to permeate organizations with really tough questions. And I've been doing that now for about 6 months, and it's been, again, wildly successful. I'm really kind of shocked at the amazing response I've gotten on that.
That was Jeffrey Tobias Halter, corporate gender strategist and president of consulting company Why Women. He is based in Georgia. Alex Tizon recently wrote about his family's slave, Lola. Some praise Tizon for his courage in confronting a dark chapter in his family's history, while others see a lack of courage in telling the story at a time when no one can be held accountable. KALW Sandeep Roy takes a look.
The ashes filled a black plastic box about the size of a toaster. It weighed 3.5 pounds. I put it in a canvas tote bag and packed it in my suitcase this past July for the Trans-Pacific flight to Manila. From there, I would travel by car to a rural village. When I arrived, I would hand over all that was left of the woman who had spent 56 years as a slave in my family's household.
The slave is Eudocia Tomas Pulido, or Lola, the family nanny of Pulitzer-winning journalist Alex Tizon. His Atlantic cover story, published posthumously, is causing a sensation, a story of modern-day slavery in America. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata. Pulido was given as a gift to Tizon's mother in the Philippines. She followed the family to the United States and raised Alex and his siblings without pay. She was not allowed to go back to visit her family. She was abused by Tizon's parents. In the end, when she was finally free, she had nowhere to go. Some praised Tizon for his courage in confronting a dark chapter in his family's history. Some see a lack of courage in telling the story at a time when no one can be held accountable. When I read it, I was moved and appalled, but most of all, I was struck by one thing. It was news only because it was happening in America. Some variation of that same story happens all over India every day. My sister and I, too, were raised by someone much like Alex Tizon's Lola. She was not given as a gift to anyone. She was paid, though I don't know how much. She went home regularly. I grew up playing with her grandchildren, Chordi, or little sister, as we called her. Widowed early in life, nursed my dying great-grandmother, wiped the children's bottoms, emptied bedpans without complaint. Unlike Tizon's Lola, she was able to retire back home with money my father gave her. One day she came back from a bath in the village pond, felt uneasy, lay down, and died. She accumulated a lot of virtue, my mother said admiringly. That's why her death was so peaceful. It's a familiar story about the old family retainer, more loyal than the children. How often have we heard a servant described as not really a servant, practically family? The servant will rarely dare say that about the master's family. It's the master's prerogative to extend that largesse to the maid, as long as she does not sit on the bed. I don't remember Chordi ever sitting on any of our sofas. It did not occur to us that there was anything strange about that. But coming to the West, we are embarrassed about this, as Tizon was when his friend Billy confronted him about his Lola.
When I once referred to Lola as a distant aunt, Billy reminded me that when we'd first met, I'd said she was my grandmother. Well, she's kind of both, I said mysteriously. Why is she always working? She likes to work, I said. Your dad and mom, why do they yell at her? Her hearing isn't so good. Admitting the truth would have meant exposing us all.
What that makes clear is that even as we talk about how we cannot judge these complicated feudal relationships in the Philippines or India by black and white Western standards, in our hearts, we cringe. That is why in every case of domestic help abuse with Indian employers in the West, someone always says she was just like family, as if that excuses everything. An Indian consul general's maid complained she was forced to work long hours for just $300 a month, her passport confiscated, and she had to sleep in the closet. A landlord in Berkeley was accused of trafficking poor women from his native village in India. He faced a court in America, but in his village, he was treated as a god. New York perfume millionaires were convicted of beating their Indonesian maids with brooms. But to the outside world, they insisted, they were not servants, they were just like family. That's our problem. Our Lolas and Chordis are not family or just like family. By calling them family, we are not honoring them. We are just trying to make ourselves feel better. But what would be better all around is if we treated them as what they are, workers and employees. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1455.